From Storyflow, this is your daily audio brief. It's Chloe, July 31st. 10 stories, evidence-led, no fluff, small inputs compound. Let's get into it. First, from Lucas Volga. Ask a friend. Portable protein with minimal cooking required. I'm excited you asked about quick high-protein wraps you can throw together anywhere. The core idea is to keep the tortilla, prefer the larger whole grain burrito size, plus a handful of ready-made proteins, canned beans, vacuum-packed tofu, pre-cooked eggs, deli meats, or tinned fish. Add a splash of flavour with store-bought dips like hummus or pesto, and bulk it up with pre-cut veggies, shredded cabbage, or a simple slaw. A few crunchy extras, nuts, roasted chickpeas, or cheese crisps give texture and extra protein. All of these items stay stable in a hotel fridge or a car trunk, so you can assemble a nutritious wrap in minutes without any cooking. Next, second, from JW By, 1,194. Context doesn't scale. You know how sometimes we try to apply a solution that works in one context to a completely different situation, but it just doesn't pan out? That's because the solution is based on metis, or the kind of intelligence that comes from experience and understanding of a specific context. The problem is, metis is inherently local and can't be scaled up without losing its effectiveness. This is exactly what happens when top-down management tries to impose a standardized system on a complex situation. The logic of the managers is abstract and intended to be universal, but it doesn't account for the unique details and nuances of the local context. As a result, the solution often ends up being less effective or even counterproductive. The issue is that we tend to think that if something is effective in one context, we can just scale it up and make it work everywhere. But that's not how metis works. It's not about creating a one-size-fits-all solution, but about understanding the specific context and developing a solution that's tailored to it. So, if you're thinking about expanding or scaling what you do, ask yourself, will that undermine the best parts, or will it make things worse? Up next, third, from Amy Odell, Retail Confessions, Ralph Lauren. Ralph Lauren's struggles in the past few years have been well documented, but a recent conversation with the designer himself sheds new light on the brand's current state. Lauren acknowledges that the company has been trying to appeal to a younger demographic, but this effort has led to a watering down of the brand's signature preppy aesthetic. He admits that this shift has alienated some of the brand's loyal customers, who feel that the quality and craftsmanship have suffered as a result. Lauren also talks about the challenges of navigating the fast fashion landscape, where high-end brands are under pressure to keep up with the speed and affordability of fast fashion retailers. He notes that this has led to a race to the bottom in terms of pricing and quality, which is unsustainable for luxury brands like his own. One of the most interesting aspects of the conversation is Lauren's discussion of the brand's relationship with its core customer. He acknowledges that the brand has become too focused on appealing to a broader audience, rather than staying true to its roots and loyal customer base. This has led to a sense of disconnection between the brand and its most dedicated followers. Lauren also touches on the topic of sustainability, which has become a major concern for the fashion industry as a whole. He notes that the brand is working to reduce its environmental impact, but acknowledges that this is a complex and ongoing process. He also expresses frustration with the lack of clear guidelines and regulations around sustainability in the fashion industry. Overall, Lauren's conversation provides a nuanced and candid look at the challenges facing the fashion industry and the specific struggles of a brand like Ralph Lauren. While the brand has made efforts to appeal to a younger demographic, it's clear that this has come at a cost, and that the brand is still searching for a way to stay true to its roots while also remaining relevant in a rapidly changing market. And then, fourth, from Amy Adele, Gwyneth Paltrow's strategic Marty Supreme fashion game. So I was reading about Gwyneth Paltrow's approach to fashion, and it's actually pretty interesting. She's been playing a long game, using her personal style to build her brand and stay relevant in the industry. It's not just about wearing nice clothes, but about creating a persona and aesthetic that people associate with her. From what I've seen, Paltrow has been able to balance high-end fashion with a more laid-back, effortless vibe. She's not afraid to take risks and try new things, but at the same time, she's also very intentional about the image she presents to the world. It's a delicate balance, but it seems to be working for her. I think what's notable about Paltrow's approach is that it's not just about the clothes themselves, but about the story she's telling through her fashion choices. She's using her platform to promote a certain lifestyle and aesthetic, and it's resonating with a lot of people. Whether or not you personally like her style, it's hard to deny that she's been successful in building a brand and creating a loyal following. It's also worth noting that Paltrow's approach to fashion is closely tied to her overall brand and business strategy. She's not just a celebrity who happens to wear nice clothes. She's an entrepreneur who is using her personal style to promote her products and services. It's a savvy move, and it's helped her build a successful business empire. Overall, I think Paltrow's approach to fashion is a great example of how personal style can be used to build a brand and create a loyal following. It's not just about wearing nice clothes, it's about telling a story and creating a persona that resonates with people. Next, fifth, from IzzyB97, Cantonese breakfast soup. So I was reading about this Cantonese breakfast soup, and it seems like a really comforting dish. The recipe I saw makes about 4 to 6 servings, and it's pretty straightforward. You'll need some bone-in chicken thighs, a bunch of green onions, and a large ginger root. The green onions should be cut into thirds with the roots removed, and the ginger root should be sliced into about 2 to 3 inches. It's interesting that the recipe doesn't have a ton of ingredients, but it still sounds like it could be really flavourful. I'm not sure what makes it specifically a breakfast soup, but I'm curious to learn more. The person who wrote about it seems to really love it, and they even made a huge batch for a soup cook-off. I don't have any information on the nutritional content or any specific health benefits of this soup, but it does seem like it could be a nice, warming meal. If you're looking for a new recipe to try, this might be worth checking out. I'd love to hear more about it if you've tried making it before. The recipe seems pretty easy to follow, and it doesn't require any special equipment or ingredients. If you're in the mood for something comforting and soothing, this might be a good option. Let me know if you have any questions or if you'd like more information. It's also worth noting that the original recipe makes a pretty large batch of soup, so you might want to adjust the ingredient quantities if you're only cooking for 1 or 2 people. I'm not sure how well the soup freezes, but that could be an option if you don't want to eat it all right away. Overall, the Cantonese breakfast soup seems like a nice, comforting dish that's worth trying. If you're interested in learning more, I can try to find some additional information or recipes for you. Up next, sixth, from Easy Guy Oven, browned butter corn madeleines. So I've been experimenting with madeleines, those small French cakes with a signature hump. It turns out that the key to getting a good bump isn't just about chilling the batter or using the right amount of baking powder. I found that the viscosity and moisture content of the batter play a huge role. Thinner batters with more liquid ingredients rose higher than thicker ones. This is because the thinner batter sets on the outside but remains raw and liquidy on the inside, allowing it to expand upward and outward. In fact, I think the thinner batter's higher water content, which turns to steam and expands in the oven, also gives it a boost. So, if you want to make madeleines with a good hump, try using a batter with a higher liquid content. I also found that using a dark nonstick pan can help the cakes rise and form a signature bump, but be careful not to overbake them. One thing to keep in mind is that staggering the tin, filling only every other well, can also help the madeleines rise a bit higher. However, this also means they'll bake slightly faster, so keep an eye on them. And unless you have a 16-cup tin, you'll have to bake in two batches anyway. And then, seventh, from scaled down. Summer, steak and beans. I turned 34 last week, bringing with it the standard, yet always surprising, existential crisis surrounding the day. I think it's one of my most annoying traits that I can't seem to outgrow being just a little emo on my birthday. I worked, heard from loved ones, and went out with my husband for a slew of small plates, getting buzzed plus off a single Negroni and glass of Tempranillo. I opened presents and saw a preview of a custom tote bag coming in the mail next month, one that I've been lusting after for a while now. By any measure, a great day. Next, eighth, from the dinner plan. Good advice, what to eat when it's too hot to cook dinner. I've pulled together the best no-cook dinner ideas from the 15 food pros who answered our too-hot-to-cook call. The common thread is simple. Use something already cooked or ready to eat, toss it with fresh veggies, herbs, and a quick dressing, and you've got a satisfying meal without heating up the kitchen. A favourite is shredded rotisserie chicken mixed with a green goddess sauce. Basil, mint, cilantro, scallion, lemon juice, garlic, salt, and Greek yogurt blended together. Pair it with whatever veg you have, corn, tomatoes, snap peas, or serve it on crackers or Ezekiel bread. Another go-to is any cooked protein, carne asada, fish, tofu, beans, combined with seasonal fruit like watermelon or heirloom tomatoes, then dressed with lime or lemon juice, olive oil, garlic, and a pinch of chiltepín or other chilies. The sweet-savoury contrast feels especially refreshing in the heat. For a lighter option, try a bean-based ceviche. Rinse a can of garbanzos, marinate them in lime juice, then add soy sauce, Worcestershire, tomato paste, mayo, and avocado. Serve on tostadas or with crackers. If you prefer something more Mediterranean, a classic salad niçoise works. Pre-boiled potatoes, green beans, hard-boiled eggs, canned tuna, olives, and a mustard vinegar vinaigrette, all assembled on a platter for easy portioning. A few other quick picks: chilled shrimp with mayo and Old Bay on a bun, cold cucumber soup, Japanese salmon noodles tossed with dashi concentrate and thinly sliced veggies, or silken tofu topped with a ginger scallion oil drizzle and sesame seeds. Keep a pint of mint chip ice cream handy for a sweet finish, and you've got a ready-to-go menu for any 90-plus degree day. Up next, ninth, from there à l'Emily in Paris, the French Edit, an idyllic French island. So I was reading this thing called The French Edit, and it's like a behind-the-scenes look at France, but not just the usual tourist stuff. It's more about the little quirks and rules that locals know, but visitors might not. Anyway, the author, Emily, is sharing some insider info about this super charming island in France that's still relatively off the radar. She's not revealing too much about her summer trip plans, but she's giving us a taste of what makes this island so special. Apparently, it's the perfect little getaway that even influencers haven't discovered yet. And then, 10th, from Ed Kimber. Beyond the basics, sour cherry pie. I've been digging into that sour cherry pie piece you sent over, and here's the lowdown. The author's main point is that the real magic of a great pie lies in a crisp bottom crust, and they break down five practical ways to keep it from turning soggy. First, bake the pie directly on a preheated pizza stone or steel. Metal conducts heat straight to the crust, so you skip the tray that would otherwise soak up the heat. Second, they suggest a thin layer of ground almonds, or breadcrumbs, ma semolina if you prefer, under the fruit. The nuts absorb excess juice as it bakes, adding a subtle flavour while protecting the crust. Third, pre-cook the cherry filling just until it releases a lot of juice, then thicken it with a bit of cornstarch. That way, the liquid is already reduced and won't soak into the pastry. Fourth, give the pastry enough time in the oven to turn a rich golden brown, not a pale yellow, so the bottom has a chance to set fully. Finally, stick with metal pie plates. They conduct heat far better than glass or ceramic, reinforcing that crisp base. On the side note, the writer runs a weekly baking newsletter called The Boy Who Bakes, offering a new recipe each week for a modest fee, currently discounted by 20% for new subscribers. If you love these deep dive tips, it might be worth checking out. That's the read. Small inputs, compounding results. Back tomorrow. Want this every morning? It's free. Set up your own feed at storyflow.com.